It's the Burt Cohen Show. America. Yes, there is America, and there is also our reach across the world. The U.S. has been, well, let's face it, imperialist for quite some time, at least since the beginning of the 20th century. And you would think maybe it's changed a little bit since then. We've learned from a huge amount of errors, and perhaps things have changed under President Barack Obama. People did vote for change, did they not? Well, Central America has long been a focus of U.S. foreign policy. We've gotten involved there again and again and again. I have no idea how many times and in how many countries. And there is the country of Honduras, which is in Central America and has had some political changes. There was just an election at the end of November, and kind of sounds like democracy, but maybe it isn't all that it seems. Well, I'm very pleased to have with us Don Paley, journalist from Vancouver, British Columbia. I believe you're in Montreal today. Is that right, Don?
That is correct.
Well, Don Paley has written for magazines and newspapers, including The Guardian, The Nation, Ms. Magazine, The Globe and Mail, and others. She's currently working on her first book, tentatively titled Drug War Capitalism. Sounds interesting, which will come out from AK Press in the fall of 2014. Don has a master's in journalism from the University of British Columbia, and she traveled throughout Honduras in order to cover the recent elections for The Nation magazine. She's based in Mexico City. Well, again, Don, thanks very much for being with us. Bring us up to date, if you would, please. Since Obama took office in 2009, what did Hondurans expect and what did they get? It all started when the president was, I believe it's Manuel Zelaya.
Right. Well, if we go back to 2009, Manuel Zelaya, or Mel Zelaya, was the president at the time. And he was slowly responding to pressure from really organized social movements in Honduras. So little things were happening that were indicating that Zelaya, who was a member of the Liberal Party and wasn't considered particularly progressive, was actually starting to just listen and maybe be inspired a little bit by some of the other political currents happening in South America. And so you had things like a slight raise in minimum wage, some responses. There was a freeze on opening up new mines, big gold mines, which was another really controversial thing, and people were protesting against it. So there was these slow moves by the Zelaya administration to actually respond to some of the pressure from social movements in Honduras. And that built up to June 29th, 2009. So by this time, Obama's in office already. That day, there was supposed to be a plebiscite. And the plebiscite was going to ask Hondurans whether or not they would like to have a process of a constituent assembly. So a process of rewriting the constitution. This is something that's taken place in progressive nations throughout Latin America. For example, Bolivia and Ecuador just went through this process recently. And that same day that there was supposed to be a plebiscite on whether or not there would be, you know, this new process of potential opening, because the current constitution of Honduras was written, you know, basically during a military government. So during that same day, that morning, when they were supposed to have this vote that was representing like another little opening of democracy in Honduras, Manuel Zelaya was actually removed from his residence, the presidential residence, in his pajamas.
Yeah, not too
in
subtle.
The early hours of the morning, and he was flown out to Costa Rica. And so it was, you know, carried out by members of the military, and it was, you know, one of the first, I think, if not the first, you know, military coup during Barack Obama's administration. And within days, it was, you know, relations were relatively normalized between the now coup government and the Obama administration. So there was no outcry, there was no protest, other than, of course, by people in the United States who protested against the coup. But the Obama government absolutely went along with the coup that took place in Honduras, and which took place at the behest of the interests of a very, very small elite in Honduras. So, you know, I think from the beginning of the Obama administration, Hondurans have been aware that the idea of hope and the idea of change is very, very far from reality, at least in their case.
Yeah, it does appear in many cases to have been a marketing tool and not much else. Now, in other Latin American countries, Central American countries, there's, you know, a long history of not particularly democratic changes of government. There certainly there was the war in El Salvador and in Nicaragua, Guatemala. But then you got Costa Rica, which has a tradition of democracy. What about Honduras? Has there been a long history of coups there?
Well, Honduras has a slightly different history, you know, than the other surrounding countries. So it shares a border with El Salvador, with Guatemala, and with Nicaragua. And it was named or nicknamed in the 80s when there was, you know, really big wars, massacres, and up to and including genocide taking place in the region. People called Honduras USS Honduras. It was basically used as a supply area, heavily militarized. There was multiple U.S. bases. And, you know, although the conflict, the armed conflict in Honduras was certainly not as intense as it was in the surrounding countries, it was basically used as a platform from which to send, you know, Contras into Nicaragua or to train people to go into Guatemala and so on. So that was sort of Honduras's role at that time, somewhere between, you know, peace in the sense that if you look at the numbers of disappeared or murdered during the internal conflict, there was, you know, a lot of disappearance, a lot of politicized violence and political violence against dissenters and so on happening in Honduras in the 80s and in the 90s, but certainly not to the same levels as, you know, as in Guatemala or as in El Salvador or Nicaragua. In terms of the history of coups, I do think that there has been coups in Honduras' past. I don't have this information right on hand with me, but I do know that what happened in 2009 was unprecedented, essentially, since peacetime, at least, in Central America.
Yeah, and we allegedly like to have democracy down there, but the U.S., and even that phrase, down there, I mean, people throughout the years have called Central America our backyard. Well, it's not our backyard, it's their yard, and you know, to suggest that it's our territory is a bit odd. I don't think we would like it, certainly. Well, there was this coup in 2009. The U.S. recognized the government right away, even though its real legitimacy was certainly questionable at best. There was a recent election at the end of November. How transparent was that election? And, you know, wasn't there some degree of hope that that would show that, well, Honduras has moved to a democracy? So how transparent was that election and how close was it?
Well, between 2009 and the recent elections that took place in November, there was elections that took place. They took place in November of 2009. So those first elections after the coup were highly questionable. Political dissenters, opponents, were unable to organize themselves, and there was really it was basically a sham election, the ones in 2009. They took place while Mel Zelaya was hidden in the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, Honduras. So he had taken refuge there. He snuck back into the country and was hidden in the Brazilian embassy while the elections were taking place in 2009. So that gives an idea of sort of the level to which those initial elections following the coup were sham elections. Zelaya was eventually, he left the country and then later returned to the country. And when he returned, a decision was made among many people participating in social movements, so people who were organizing, you know, regular marches and local committees to protest the coup, to protest the sham elections, to organize against, you know, repression, which was very, very intense against people organizing, you know, against what they consider to be an illegitimate government. When Zelaya returned from exile, he formed or was called to form a new political party. And that new political party integrated people from the Liberal Party, so his supporters, who were fired, who were sacked, who were run out of office themselves following the coup. So there was former Liberals joining with social movement people, people who'd been active in the streets and the local organizing committees. That new party is called Libre. It's the Freedom and Refoundation Party. And the person who was chosen to lead the party is Xiomara Castro, who is Mel Zelaya's wife. There's no re-election in Honduras, so he was prohibited again from being president. So the Libre Party represents a completely new political force in Honduras. There's no precedent for a meaningful third party outside of the traditional liberal and national parties. There's no real precedent for any kind of progressive party. I mean, I guess you could compare it to the United States. And, right. You know, these guys, they got 39 Congress people elected in the last elections. There was a lot of hope. There was a lot of buzz. There was a lot of people, I think, who'd never found electoral politics to be all that meaningful or engaging in Honduras, including a lot of young people who, you know, put their heart and soul behind trying to get a Libre member elected to Congress or to the presidency. You asked me about transparency. I mean, it's a very difficult question. There's no doubt that there was election day fraud, which means, you know, on the day of the voting and the days following the actual counting of the ballots, there's a lot of irregularities. There's, you know, most certainly results that weren't tallied properly. Mm-hmm. However, I would, you know, I would say, and in talking with a lot of people in Honduras, it does appear that the National Party won the elections. You know, even though there was these irregularities and frauds going on election day, I think what's often missed in the discussion of what I like to call election day fraud instead of election fraud is that in the months and the years leading up to the election, that's when I think a lot of the practices that are highly questionable take place. We're talking about, you know, recorded vote buying, so millions of dollars of money from Congress, you know, coming from the Honduran taxpayers, being used to buy cement and give it to people in return for a vote for that same party. So The National Party won the 2009 elections, and they've just won the elections that took place in November. And I think, you know, we're talking about years of vote buying. The National Party and the Liberal Party in Honduras are both over 100 years old. They have huge institutional, you know, networks, support bases. They can mobilize voters. So I think all that kind of stuff was going on in the time leading up to the election. And then also there was a lot of violence, and the violence particularly political assassinations and, you know, politically motivated assassinations against the Libre Party in particular, although all the parties had, you know, people murdered, their activists, grassroots activists, you know, candidates murdered in the time leading up to the election. I think that's another important element to consider when we're talking about, you know, not just transparency, but the legitimacy of these elections that took place in Honduras.
If you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Don Paley. We're talking about Honduras. What's the reality there? Is there democracy there? What's involved, and why? And certainly, we know that throughout other Central American countries, there's been a left generally, and in 1970, I believe, no, 1973, September 11th, when there was a legitimately elected left-leaning president in Chile, the U.S. came down, thank you, Henry Kissinger, and overthrew the legitimately elected government with great violence. And the power of the left throughout Central America has varied quite a bit. For example, as I mentioned, in Costa Rica, I don't think there's a very substantial left in El Salvador. There was a military struggle in the 80s. The FMLN was the left, and now they're in power through legitimate political electoral means. And obviously Nicaragua, there's been a significant left. But you're saying that in Honduras, there's been the Liberal Party and the National Party. And so is the left tendency or the left sentiment among the people, has it been there for a long time, or is this something new? And could it be in reaction to what happened in 2009, if it is something new?
Interesting question. I think it's certainly long been there. I just think that it perhaps hasn't played out in the realm of electoral politics the way it has in other countries. And certainly, though, the 2009 coup transformed the political landscape. And I think that the formation of the Libre Party, that, again, it didn't win the presidency, but it's now the second political force in Honduras, displacing the Liberal Party, you know, is a very significant change in terms of the electoral landscape in Honduras. And there is no doubt that that is essentially a direct inheritance of the 2009 military coup.
Interesting how, to every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. And when Evo Morales was first elected in Bolivia, my guest, I asked her about, would he have been elected without the pressure from George Bush the other way? And she said, probably, but it certainly helped to have the pressure from the U.S. And, you know, it seems to be happening yet again. And so there were the two institutional parties. I know that oftentimes in many countries in Latin America, there's a large young population who, you know, are interested in getting jobs and being able to live and feed themselves. Is that a significant factor when it comes to peeling away support from the National Party and the Liberal Party, do you think, the young people?
I mean, I think definitely Honduras is one of those countries that has, you know, demographically just a lot of youth. I think it's one of the youngest countries, so to say, in Latin America. It's also one of the poorest countries in Latin America. And right now is the country in the world with the highest murder rate. And so those factors all together mean that you definitely do have a segment of young people, an important segment of young people, voters, and folks organizing within the political parties. But you also have a lot of people who are, you know, a lot of young people, and I've met and interviewed these people as they're migrating to the United States, because there really isn't a lot of hope for jobs or a lot of promise of there being some kind of economic revival in Honduras. I mean, honestly, even if Libre would have won the elections, they would be inheriting a country that is not bankrupt, but close to insolvent. So that is another factor that I think, you know, cannot be ignored. Right now, remittances or, you know, people sending money back from the U.S. to Honduras is the country's number one source of revenue.
Whoa.
So, you know, there is a huge amount of youth participation, and it's very, very important in the political scene and so on. But I also think that, you know, it has to be acknowledged that I think a lot of the, you know, the people that can, the people that have an opportunity, a family member in the United States are leaving in droves.
My goodness. And I want to ask a little bit more about the demographics and, you know, the economy there. And tradition in many Latin American countries has been to have a few ruling families. That's gone on and on and on for many, many years, and certainly was the case in El Salvador and other countries as well. Has that been the case in Latin America, or has there been a significant middle class?
In Honduras?
Yes.
Honduras is an interesting case. You have essentially a handful of families, but you know, who are essentially controlling the most vibrant segment of the economy, which is essentially the importation of unfinished goods and the assembly of those goods, mm-hmm. not necessarily finishing, but putting together. So, for example, importing screws and pieces and exporting car parts, or also garments. That's, you know, one of the most important, I would say definitely the most important segment of the Honduran economy. You know, the famous maquiladoras that everyone talks about, the maquilas. These are mostly all controlled by a handful of families, mostly of Palestinian Christian descent, who came in the early 20th century as merchants to Honduras. And they displaced, you know, the early Spanish land-holding elite early on. So these families who I like to, you know, imagine them as, these families are essentially linked right in with a transnationalized capitalism. They, you know, they are completely tied into a global market in terms of what they're importing for assembly and where they're exporting it to. It actually has nothing to do with Honduras. What, you know, what they get from being in Honduras is an extremely precarious labor force that, you know, they can recruit to work for a pittance. We're talking about some of the lowest wages in the hemisphere. And also the fact that they essentially do not have to pay taxes in Honduras. So those are two big draws. But again, we're talking about, I can't give you a number, but I would say no more than a dozen families somewhere in that neighborhood. Who, some of the members of these families have been involved in politics, but it's sort of a class of people that actually don't really involve themselves that much in the politics. They're not running for Congress,
right?
Or running for mayor in their local, you know, community. They're more behind the scenes and operating, I think, at a completely different level. And these are the people that we believe, you know, myself and other historians and researchers believe are essentially those responsible for ordering the coup in 2009. They're people with a very low, relatively low public profile. The only way you really read about them is like in the society pages of the country's biggest newspaper. But yes, it certainly has, you know, that similar, I mean, I believe it is now the most unequal country in the hemisphere, Honduras, since the coup. So you just have this really, really small elite, and then, you know, more than 60% of the population living in poverty or extreme poverty.
That's pretty impressive to be, I mean, we have a huge disparity here in the currently United States, and to say that they're the worst is it paints a pretty clear picture. Here in the U.S., there's been, traditionally, there was a middle class, and certainly the founders of this country recognized that in order to have a democracy, you have to have a middle class. Well, the middle class has largely been decimated here since Ronald Reagan, and obviously Ronald Reagan has had an interest in the politics of Latin America as well. Was there a middle class? Has it gotten worse since the coup of 2009, the economic divide and the poverty rate?
It has definitely gotten worse. I mean, that's a tough question. I haven't studied, you know, the history of the middle class in Honduras, but we know that it's gotten worse. A report came out just before the elections from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, where they found that the poverty rate increased by 13% between 2010 and 2012, and the extreme poverty rate went up by 26%. So in the 2 years following the coup, the country just, I mean, the country has been in crisis for a long time. But after the coup, it spiraled, essentially, it spiraled out of control. And the other thing that happened, and again, I don't think this is coincidental, as inequality surged, violence also, you know, has gone off the charts. Honduras, a country of just over 8 million people, now has about 20 murders a day. And the second biggest city in Honduras is now considered the murder capital of the world as of 2011. So you've got these phenomena of, you know, the the rift between the rich and the poor just getting so big, I think we can. It's very difficult to even comprehend it. I mean, the wealthy in Honduras living in palaces, and someone said to me, well, where do the rich go? Where do the Honduran rich go on vacation? So if we were in Mexico, we might say, oh, you know, they go to Acapulco, or they go to, and the answer in Honduras is they go to Miami. They go to, like, you know, Long Beach, California. They live on another planet. They go right. shopping for the weekend, you know, in the galleries in Los Angeles and so on. So, you know, the majority of the population are folks who, you know, are usually surviving off of one family member or a handful of family members who are working often as undocumented laborers in the United States. So it's a huge rift. It's a huge, huge rift. And, you know, the middle class, I don't want to say it's non-existent, but it's certainly difficult to perceive when you're there, when you're walking around in the streets, and especially in the rural areas.
Well, you certainly spark a lot of questions. Again, we're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Don Paley about recent election in Honduras. Election, maybe. I guess it was somewhat legitimate, but what are the changes there? What does the U.S. Get out of this? Now, the new president, I believe, is Hernandez. He promised to open up the country to make more foreign investment. Well, what's wrong with that? Doesn't that help create jobs? Is that a good thing? Is that something that was widely popular, his proposal on that?
Well, you know, actually all of the candidates, including Xiomara Castro, the National Party candidate, and the Liberal Party candidate, they all promised to open Honduras to foreign direct investment. I think it's like saying, you know, what president is going to campaign and say, I'm not going to create jobs.
Right.
What the actual impacts of foreign direct investment are is almost another discussion entirely, but certainly the campaign promise to bring in new investments and create new jobs, it went all the way across the board, like all the major parties were making that promise. What we do see, though, is that foreign direct investment, for example, if it's in the maquila sector, the assembly sector, it's essentially providing, you know, maybe $5 a day, maybe, to workers, and, you know, lining the pockets of these same elites that I mentioned before with millions of dollars a year.
Well, there has...
So that's one possible impact of foreign direct investment. There's other sectors, of course, outside of the maquila sector. Honduras is... one thing that's kind of amazing about it, I found, was in traveling around, is that there's all these rivers all over the place, rushing rivers, gorgeous. There's a lot of water, and there's a lot of intact forest still.
Mm.
And, you know, there's plans to build a whole bunch of new dams and to build a whole bunch of new mines and, you know, to get, you know, raw materials from Honduras to obviously feed the appetite of primarily, you know, U.S., residents, consumers, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
where these raw resources would go, or the energy.
Sure.
And these projects are extremely controversial in Honduras. People have seen time and again that, you know, the way that these mega mine projects or these big dam projects happen ends up actually displacing local people instead of helping them. So it's not like there's going to be a dam by your house you can connect up and you guys can all have electricity now. It's more like there's going to be a dam by your house, so you're not going to have a house anymore. And if you protest, if you don't agree and you stand on the road and protest, we will send the military and they will threaten to kill you. And as it happened over the summer with someone who was part of a protest against a dam project in central Honduras, just, you know, he was killed. So this is the kind of foreign direct investment that's extremely controversial and that, you know, it's hard to imagine a benevolent corporation that's going to mm-hmm. come to Honduras, pay people fair wages, mm-hmm. take care of the environment. I mean, that is not why a corporation would invest in Honduras. They would do so because the labor is accessible, it's cheap, it's precarious, it's essentially disposable.
Right.
There's no environmental control. So we visited a closed down mine site while I was there that they just left piles of toxic tailings, just with all they have between these piles and the roads that the communities use and near schools and so on is a chain link fence. So, I mean, that's kind of, I think, the more of the reality of what foreign direct investment means for the people that actually live in Honduras. The majority, the poor majority of people in Honduras, of course there'll be some beneficiaries from it, but I don't think it's the mass population. And I think that, you know, this kind of promise to increase foreign direct investment, it's like, if they don't make that promise, maybe they're like a communist bad guy or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was certainly no, there was members within the Libre Party who were taking more radical positions on certain things, but in general, it was fairly well in accordance, I would say, with Washington's parameters for what is acceptable political discourse as well.
So then why is the U.S. involved? What is, I mean, aside from the obvious race to the bottom, which is, you know, all about, I mean, that's a huge part of the state of capitalism in the 21st century, just pay as little as possible with as few environmental standards as possible. What is America's interest in Honduras, and how well known is that? Is this something that's quite transparent?
Well, I think what we've been seeing recently, in addition to what you mentioned about the race to the bottom, is that Honduras, after maybe a decade or a decade and a half of sort of falling off as being the U.S.'s main military site in Central America, that is being reactivated now. And I would say that is the U.S.'s primary interest in Honduras. So the U.S. still runs an Air Force base out of Honduras. It's called the U.S. Joint Task Force Bravo. It's just like an hour outside of the capital city. And three new U.S. naval bases were announced in August. Well, they announced that they were constructing these new bases. So what we're seeing is a remilitarization of Honduras that includes permanent U.S. bases with permanent U.S. troops stationed at those bases. The discourse now for that remilitarization is the war on drugs. But, you know, Honduras has access to, all of these countries. Location is everything. And I think that Honduras' strategic location is really what's of interest at this point to the United States.
But in terms of the military base there, I'm thinking about location of threats to the U.S. Let's see, there's a newly elected president of Chile who leans slightly left. Threats? What's the purpose of a huge military presence there? I mean, I would think China might be more of a, you know, genuine economic and military threat to us than countries there. Maybe it's a good stopover place to protect us from China?
Well, I think what we're talking about is not threats to the, like, it's not that Honduras is a threat to the United States. It's more the concept of Honduras as a platform, again. Hmm. Honduras as a platform where the U.S. can fill Honduras with soldiers. From there, they have access to the Pacific, to the Caribbean, mm-hmm. to the Caribbean nations, to Venezuela, to Colombia. It's a stone's throw away from all of these places, and they essentially have free reign. In a way, you know, the U.S. doesn't. In Mexico, for example, where U.S. military are not allowed to, you know, have bases and walk around armed, and according to the Mexican Constitution, that can't happen there. And the U.S. just closed the Manta base in Ecuador not that long ago after Ecuador refused to renew the contract. They have new military bases in Colombia, and so there's a remilitarization of the whole region. Uh-huh. The way the U.S. government presents this threat is that there is a threat presented by drug traffickers. So these drug traffickers who are moving particularly cocaine from Colombia, from the Andean region, up into the United States, they present a threat to the health of U.S. citizens. That's the kind of discourse that we hear right now. Once in a while, someone will float something in from the State Department about there maybe being some involvement of terrorists and so on. But in general, the threat is portrayed as being linked to drug trafficking. I'm on side with you. I don't actually think Honduras or any of these countries represents an actual threat to the U.S. in terms of some kind of military threat.
Right.
Certainly not. But what we're seeing is a remilitarization of the whole region. And I think, you know, from my perspective, it has a lot to do with, it's a long game. They're playing a long game. I mean, eventually, people in Honduras will revolt. They will not accept poverty. I mean, I don't think it's that far away from a situation of food riots, to be honest with you.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that maybe not this year, maybe not in 5 years, but when if things continue on the way that they're continuing economically, for example, in Honduras and other countries in the region, there will be uprisings. And I think that that's the long game the United States is playing in having, you know, military bases all over the place and the capacity to basically quell or prevent mass movement of people also towards the United States, for example, on a greater scale than what we're seeing today.
Wow, quite a story. We're talking with Don Paley about new political realities in Honduras. And you talk about the role of the U.S. military there, very heavy presence. I guess the base is at least near Tegucigalpa.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of they're able to walk around armed. What about the role of police in the politics of Honduras? Are they very militarized as well?
Well, that's a very good question, and I am certainly not an expert on the police history of Honduras, but there was a few developments before the election that were very interesting. So there was a period when local police officers were doing essentially a kind of a work stoppage because they weren't being paid. And you know when you aren't paying police that there's a real crisis, right?
Yeah,
so
really.
There had been work stoppages by doctors and teachers, all of which could almost be chalked up as normal in the sense that they happen frequently. And, you know, they're organized trade unions and they're, you know, somehow got back to the negotiating table and both the teachers and the doctors went back to work before the strike. But the police, they didn't strike, but they were doing work stoppages and, you know, saying that they weren't getting their full paychecks. I mean, it's the same thing you hear from any kind of state employee in Honduras. They weren't getting their full paychecks or they were coming extremely late. People were going, you know, months and months and months without getting anything while they were working. And just shortly after that work stoppage, you had the introduction of a new police force. And this was a police force that was heavily promoted by the now president-elect Juan Orlando Hernandez. This is a military police force. So we saw them out patrolling. I think they deployed about 2,000 of them by the time the elections took place. And essentially they wear camo, urban camo, and you know, they're not the sort of guys with the old rifles and, you know, the kind of sort of bumbling looking police officers, which of course are heavily, heavily corrupt in Honduras and fully penetrated by narco-trafficking organizations. So the new military police are, you know, they make these guys look like, you know, curb constables or whatever they call them. The new military police definitely have a very much more intimidating presence. They have their faces covered with ski masks. And Juan Orlando Hernandez promised during the campaign that for every police officer that would be patrolling in the neighborhoods, there would be a soldier by his side. So there's been... you know, it's a kind of a campaign strategy that's actually worked in quite a few countries, like Guatemala and elsewhere, of sort of the iron fist, the sort of tough on crime approach or rhetoric. And so the creation of the new military police force is definitely, you know, one of the first developments that we've seen of that kind of policy actually being put into action. And I'm sure that the U.S. is involved in training Honduran police. Honduras is a recipient of U.S. Assistance through a program called the Central America Regional Security Initiative, which is basically like, if you've talked on your show, I'm not sure about the Merida Initiative or Plan Colombia. It's kind of like that, but for Central America. And often those plans really focus on police training and outfitting the police with everything ranging from weapons to surveillance to helicopters and so on.
Lovely. Well, I had a college professor who was, I think, very, very correct when he said politics is the economy of violence. That when the, I mean, how can that not be intimidating to have these armed, you know, very active, very well-trained, heavily armed police. But there is, as you say, a grassroots resistance movement in the country. That's got to take some chutzpah, shall we say. And it must be rather scary. Tell us about the grassroots resistance movements that may be growing in the country.
Well, we visited quite a few sites while we were there. I was traveling with another photographer from Canada, and we were able to go to the Agouan, which is a region on the Caribbean coast. It's extremely fertile, and I mean, that's the thing that really stands out at you when you're traveling through Honduras. It's not, it's lush land. Like, you feel like you could drop a seed on the ground, and it would grow a fruit tree like in a year or something. It's incredible. So in the Agouan region, there's over 2,000 families that have been maintaining a land occupation for going on 3 years now, and they have tallied 113 members of these 2,000 families have been murdered.
Oh my!
Over that time, by private security guards. Or by the army, or by a combination. So people will talk about, people dressed as army who take their clothes off, and then they look, sometimes no one's sure who's who and who's actually doing the killing. But the lands they're occupying are lands that they were granted through a formal process with the state. And, they don't consider it to be an illegal occupation in any way.
Right.
But they're being treated like squatters and like illegal occupants by the state that is actively trying to essentially eject them. But, it's quite heartening when we were there to see that people who had initially built, it's a region where there's a lot of African palm. And so they'd actually built their houses out of, like, the sticks from the palm for the walls and then the fronds for the roofs. And what we saw when we were there just a month ago was that people were actually building with brick and, bearing down and planning to stay, for the long term. And, these are folks who they just want a bit of land to farm. Many of them have family members in the United States and so on. But, there is a huge landless peasant population in Honduras, people who've been displaced through violence, through economic violence and through natural disasters. So the Agouan, occupations are very inspiring, and, regardless of all the hardship, some of the people involved in those occupations were also involved in the Libre Party, sort of sentiment that things can change, and I think still can change, but also, what folks were saying when we were there, which was before the elections, is like, even if Libre doesn't win the elections, we're still going to be here. Sorry, even if they do win, for example, if Xiomara Castro had have won the elections, the leftist party. People understand that doesn't mean that they walk away from their land occupation, their project. I think Honduras is one of the places that I've most felt just how true it is that really direct action and that kind of mobilization is sometimes the only way for people to actually achieve anything. There's also very active indigenous movements in Honduras.
I was going to ask about that. Yes.
So they're one of the most high-profile event that's been going on is a blockade against a dam project.
Yes.
That would flood a whole region and just, like, absolutely gorgeous area, extremely fertile, heavily wooded. People can, get their wood for firewood. There's clean water. So live, what would be considered by material standards, perhaps, like a poor lifestyle, but... certainly not, suffering the way an urban slum, someone who's living in a slum in an urban area would, who can't access clean water and so on. So these folks are fighting to their Lenca people, and they're fighting to keep this Chinese dam consortium off of their land. And there's a number of new dam projects in the pipeline, and so this has sort of become a bit of a flashpoint in the sense that people are watching this project in the area is called Rio Blanco as a sort of a threshold for like what will happen if these other dozens of proposed dam projects end up going forward. There's also Garifuna movements that are quite inspiring all along the Caribbean coast, and these are indigenous folks who are descendants of Africans who were enslaved and avoided enslavement because of shipwrecks that took place.
Oh.
And so the Garifuna people have been organizing against mega tourism projects and attempts to sort of push them off of these, you know, again, just stunning lands that they own and that they use communally. And there's been all kinds of efforts to sort of corral people into sort of a reservation type of situation where, you know, the big beaches and so on would be property of private hotels. And so folks have been very, very organized. And you know, I think Chutzpah's an understatement. I mean, there is right now over 3,000 peasants in Honduras that have arrest warrants out for them just for participating in these kinds of activities. I met with a few people who were under the threat of arrest and basically had to, you know, be in hiding. And there's just a lot of intimidation, and the threat mm-hmm. of going to prison in Honduras is no joke.
Ooh, I'll bet.
And that's obviously in addition to, you know, extrajudicial assassinations and disappearances and so on, which are tactics that are regularly used against organizers in Honduras.
Well, in any developing nation, certainly one of the most important things is education. We've seen in throughout a good bit of the 20th century that education is absolutely essential to real liberation. People need to learn how to read, and so that they can take, you know, participate in their economic future. What has happened to public education in the current and recent administrations? Is this an issue as well?
Absolutely, and it's actually something. I mean, you've mentioned Chile a few times, but it's something I think that has been taking place throughout Latin America over the past 5 years, which is World Bank and IMF backed, or these kind of reforms that the IMF and the World Bank are saying, you know, if you want your next loan, if you want your next, you know, dose of money, you need to reform the education system. Teachers' unions are widely considered too powerful by the international financial institutions. So, you know, I'm sure your listeners will remember the student strikes in Chile and, you know, huge, you know, mobilizations going on for weeks and weeks and months. And you had a similar type of mobilization taking place in Honduras as well, and, you know, related to similar reforms, which is basically to reduce the permanency of a teaching position. So you know, their discourse is to make teachers more accountable, but essentially, you know, through introducing things like standardized testing and even proposals, you know, that would facilitate the introduction of things like charter schools. So, you know, the teachers were, it was probably the most vibrant street protests that happened once the sort of coup protests, like, wound down. Mm-hmm. The teachers were extremely militant, but eventually the education reform package did pass. And I spoke with a number of teachers while I was in Honduras who told me that right now the number, there's around 14,000 teachers who aren't being paid fully still since the coup. And, you know, people see that as sort of punishment. So, you know, if you're identified as a teacher who protested against the coup, you won't be paid.
Mm.
And but what folks also said was that, you know, they think that unless this education package was repealed, which I think might have been a somewhat of a possibility if Libre had have won the presidency, it's obviously not going to happen now. I mean, the new government is absolutely in line with neoliberal macroeconomic management, that if these economic reforms that were finally passed are not repealed, there will again, I mean, that we can again expect massive teachers mobilization and teacher strikes in 2014 in Honduras. So it's a big deal. And, you know, the teachers and the students, I mean, following the coup, the students were the ones that organized the first big mass, sorry, not following the coup, following the elections. Also following the coup, I mean, students, university students are also, you know, an important motor. And they're aware of what's taking place in their country, and they know, I think, that the one of the only ways to actually face down this bleak future is to mobilize in the streets with their friends and with their comrades.
And I would guess that the powers that be don't want an educated population, because then people remain, you know, powerless, much more powerless without an education. And you mentioned the IMF and the World Bank. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the role of the IMF and the World Bank in Honduras.
Well, Honduras, it qualified as a heavily indebted poor country, and it achieved a certain level of debt forgiveness prior to the coup. You know, this is the kind of IMF move that only takes place when we're talking, you know, desperate. Like, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I spoke with an ex-finance minister while I was there, and, you know, the proportion of Honduras's available revenue stream that was being used to service the debt was astronomical, like more than they were spending on education. So they had some debt forgiveness, but since then, what has happened is that a huge amount of internal debt has been accrued. So Honduras has failed to qualify, I think, recently for basically after the coup spending went off the wall. And I'm sure this is linked to both corruption and just, you know, patronism, getting, you know, your people taking over the government. Honestly, what a coup does for institutionality, I think, is kind of a no-brainer. So it's been a spending spree in Honduras, and they have recently failed to qualify for an IMF standby loan. But the expectation is, well, there's two pieces here. So one, that has created a huge amount of internal debt where the Honduran government has been borrowing from private institutions within Honduras, including banks, at huge interest rates. Mm. And the second thing is that there's an expectation, this is reported in The Economist just after the elections, that Honduras will borrow or is considering, you know, another, would like to qualify for another IMF loan, I should say. And to do so, they have to make another round of cuts, which honestly, it's unthinkable.
Wow.
Basically, what they need to do is reduce another, you know, hundreds of exemptions to sales tax and other kinds of taxes, which is, you know, and raise electricity prices. Again, two things that, who are they going to hit? They're going to hit, you know, the poorest people, the majority of the country. Mm. And so the Economist reported that they expect that the new that Juan Orlando Hernandez, who is right now the president of Congress and the president elect, will sort of ram through some of these changes being asked of the IMF, being asked of Honduras by the IMF in the next month. The inauguration takes place at the end of January, so the National Party will only have their majority until then. So, I mean, it's hard to it's sometimes hard to imagine things getting worse, but it looks like with this new round of essentially of austerity that's going to take place in Honduras, it's heading, you know, right in towards you know, increasing inequality and suffering for the people of Honduras.
And yet, I see this quote from Hugo Pino, who is the former president of the Central Bank and ambassador to the U.S., who now supports Libre. Now, that party lost, and he said, quote, "If we sit back and carefully study the result of these elections, I have no doubt that it is a triumph for Libre." Don Paley, do you feel optimistic? Do you think that there is a good chance that things may get better in Honduras as the people see that, well, there's nothing to lose? Might as well, you know, let's make some real changes.
Well, I mean, I guess I've always kind of ascribed to the Gramsci quote of optimism of the spirit and pessimism of the intellect. I like to think that people, you know, I, of course, the future isn't written. We don't know what's going to happen. And it is possible that over the next 4 years, Libre regroups and is able to win, you know, a more significant part of the elections and take the presidency in 4 years from now. What that will actually change in terms of the economic situation of the country is very difficult to say.
I'm sure.
You know, Hugo Noé Pino is the person who told me that, I asked him if he would describe Honduras as bankrupt, and he said, no, I think something like insolvency would be a more appropriate word. No matter if you have a leftist party, I mean...
Yeah, it's tough work.
Getting out of the situation they're in economically is very difficult. So I'm certainly not someone who doesn't have hope and believe in the possibility for change, and especially for people in the social movements on the ground who are organizing, you know, for concrete things for their own communities. Absolutely, you know, adelante. I think that's one of the most positive things, and it does represent a shift. It's a break with a historic entrenched two-party system in Honduras. But I think that, you know, with the militarization and with the ongoing economic squeeze of Honduras's poor, the next 4 years are definitely going to be very, very difficult. You know, it's hard to say whether or not more difficult than the previous four, but we'll be watching, and you know, we'll be trying to continue reporting on it and so on.
Well, you've been very, very informative here about something that should interest people throughout the hemisphere. If people are interested in following your work, Dawn Paley, what website can you point them to, or Twitter, whatever?
Well, they could Google me. My name is Dawn Paley, and you'll find a link there to my website, which is dawnpaley.ca, and you can also find me on Facebook and on Twitter, on the internet machines. So that's what I would suggest for folks who would like to keep up. I'll be putting out a story in the next few weeks looking in more detail about the role of U.S. military aid and the U.S. military in Honduras.
Oh, boy. Very, very interesting. Thank you so much, Dawn Paley, for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show.
Thank you very, very much for having me, Bert. It's been wonderful.
Right. Thank you. We're going to go out with a little bit of Honduran rock music.
Seguiré una ruta alterna para llegar hasta vos. Cambiaré toda la estrategia para que me des tu corazón. Zapatos rotos, jeans remendados, pelo largo y camisas del Che. Discos piratas de Pink Floyd y Nirvana, de todo eso me tendré que deshacer. Mariposas, pétalos de rosas, unicornios y abrigos de piel. Música fresa de discos y fiestas, de todo eso tendré que aprender. Para encontrar una ruta alterna y así llegar hasta vos. Te enviaré flores sin nombre y sin firma, pa' que creas que hay más tontos como yo. Pasan las horas pensando en tu sonrisa, cartas bobas y sueños de papel. Mensajitos jamás contestados y más de 1400 emails. Oh, oh, oh. La economía me marca luz roja por las cosas que ayer te compré. Mi único plato es amor y esperanza, porque ya me quedé sin comer. ¿Qué es lo que tengo que hacer para que puedas quererme? Tal vez el destino me haga perder otra vez. Prefiero morirme luchando que permanecer esperando. Y no me invoques porque ahí estaré. Como pelo en la sopa te sorprenderé.